Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, commercial canning and how it changed the way we cook, eat, and think about food. We'll spend this hour with food systems scholar Anna Zeta, who traces the fascinating history of canned vegetables, meats, and beans from the early days when shoppers couldn't be sure what they were getting or if it was safe to eat, through the era of can opener cooks who embraced the convenience of factory-made meals, to the industry struggles to win back the loyalty of customers who prefer things fresh or frozen. We'll talk about regulatory battles and marketing gimmicks along the way and get a clear sense of the part cans played in getting Americans hooked on processed foods. Our conversation starts after a short break. This is Think. If you have canned beans or tuna or tomatoes on hand, you know you can throw together some kind of quick dinner without having to run to the store. Canned food is such a pantry staple that most of us never give it a second thought. But in the beginning, it took a lot of convincing to get Americans to buy it. From KERA in Dallas, you're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Imagine how weird cans were to people who had never experienced food made in a factory. They couldn't see what was inside. They had to learn to trust that what they were buying would be tasty, nutritious, and uncontaminated. It took a concerted effort by manufacturers, scientists, and marketers to create products we could trust. For better and for worse, those early efforts laid the groundwork for our eventual dependence on all kind of processed food. Anna Zeta is assistant professor of professional practice at Oklahoma State University. Her new book is called Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry, and she joins us from the studios of KOSU in Oklahoma City to talk about it. Anna, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's good to be here.
So you point out that canned food has played as big a role in shaping daily life as technologies that get a lot more attention. For one thing, foods that were once only around for a few weeks a year could be eaten in any season.
That's right. Yeah. One of the things that, you know, I think characterizes modern life more than anything is how disconnected we are from natural cycles, from the weather. You know, we have air-conditioned spaces where we spend most of our time. We don't really have to think that much about the climate unless you're a farmer. And, you know, that was just not the case 150 years ago. People's lives were very, very connected to the weather, and in one the most direct way was how they were eating. Food was, you know, on a seasonal cycle. You ate what was in season. During the winter, you had to figure out ways to preserve food or put things in the root cellar to have enough to eat. And the canning technology really emerged into that place to open up people's sense of what was possible in time and space, geography. You know, I write about how people inland were able to, you know, eat fish, not fresh, but fish, for, you know, marine fish for the first time, or people inland were eating pineapples from Hawaii. And so that sense of the vastness of geographic distance and of seasonal cycles was really collapsed through the canning technology, as it was later through the railroad and the telegraph and much bigger technologies that get more attention.
You know, I had always thought of home canning, like preserving fresh foods in sterilized glass jars, as an old-fashioned thing. I didn't realize the process wasn't perfected until the early 19th century.
That's right, yeah. And you know, I think it's an interesting relationship between the home canning and the kind of industrial canning that I spend more time writing about, because the technologies that made both possible rose in tandem. But you're right that, you know, preserving foods, whether in glass jars or other containers, not necessarily through the canning method, but relying on other kinds of preservation techniques through salting or sugaring, vinegars, pickling, you know, those kinds of technologies, you could call them that, were certainly around much older. People have had to figure out how to preserve foods for thousands of years. But the actual canning technique, which is defined basically as taking food and putting it into some kind of container, sealing it in a vacuum seal, and then heating it. You know, now we know to sort of get rid of the microbes. At the time, germ theory wasn't really understood, but that awareness that heat and vacuum sealing could create a kind of preservation that didn't require inputs of things like sugar, salt, and vinegars, or acids.
How did Nicolas Appert, the guy who really perfected this, how did he figure out how to do it safely?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and I actually would love to know more about him. I haven't, you know, found his original papers if they exist, but he was a French confectioner, so he had experience, you know, making food, experimenting with different chemical qualities of food and how they change when you make candies of various sorts in the late 1700s. And he responded to this call from Napoleon for a better way to feed Napoleon's troops. Napoleon sent out this kind of nationwide challenge for a 12,000 franc prize, who could figure out a better way to feed his troops. And a pair, I think, tinkering, you know, in the lines of food manufacturing that he'd already been doing, recognized that there was something about sealing out whatever kind of, you know, things were causing food to spoil, and that heating did something. And so I think it was probably just the result of his own, you know, interest in experimentation and tinkering in his, you know, makeshift laboratory that led him to this discovery.
So when soldiers came home, and of course canned foods were also used, you know, by soldiers in the United States and elsewhere, when they came home, they at least understood that canned food could be okay to eat, right? I'm curious about how that acceptance, though, spread to, say, the wives and mothers of these soldiers, the people who were more likely to be doing the shopping and the cooking.
Yeah, that's something, yeah, I write about in the first chapter. So after the method was sort of publicized around 1812, it spread, but very, you know, first to very closed-off audiences, that is, people who really were removed from agricultural land, so people on the move, explorers, sailors, those kinds of people, but not in the everyday home. And I attest to the importance of the Civil War in exposing really far-flung people. You know, soldiers came together from different parts of the country and were eating a common diet that wasn't so divided by region as it was without times of war to bring people together. And so when they came home, they both conveyed that taste for canned food, the trust for canned food, that they then conveyed, as you said, to their wives and mothers and others who were preparing food to say, this is something I liked. I tried it. You know, condensed milk was one of the first canned foods that the Union Army in the Civil War created a contract with canning companies, with Borden's condensed milk for. And after that, Borden's kind of became a relatively common household name. And from there, the thought that these industrial can, opaque containers that we otherwise don't know much about might have something to offer in terms of convenience, in terms of access to foods out of season. But even after the Civil War, it wasn't, you know, like immediately it took off in homes either. It was another 50 years or so with a lot of other work through agricultural development, technological development, understanding the bacteriology with the rise of germ theory that actually made canned food both safer, actually safer, and continued to spread the awareness of it as something that people might consider buying.
Yeah, and of course, you know, canning summer foods in preparation for winter is one thing if it's happening in one's own kitchen. It's another thing entirely to walk into a store and trust that this metal can that you can't see through contains something that's edible and safe and will taste okay. It's hard, Anna, to get our heads around this now, but people had no cultural experience with buying food that they couldn't see and smell and maybe even taste and touch
right
before they purchased.
Right, right. And that's, I play with the kind of metaphors of opacity and transparency in the book, in the sense that not only was this container opaque, it was kind of this black box where you didn't know when you were in the store buying it what you would see when you, you know, open inside. It wasn't just food, you know, it was, people were used to touching fabrics when they bought, you know, pieces of fabric to sew clothing out of. It was a very much more sensory kind of experience to interact with food and products that you bought. And then this can was this clearly industrial product. It had a shiny label on the outside. It was metal. Holding it in your hand gave you no indication of what was inside. And, you know, in our world today of so many packaged goods that we have come to understand how to read nutrition labels and how to look at different typography on the, you know, face of a box to know if this is intended for me as an audience or not. I think it's really hard to put ourselves into the position of these 19th century or even early 20th century consumers who had to decide whether they could, you know, let this kind of new product into their lives, whether there was space for this unknown product in an opaque container that had an opaque process that brought it from some distant factory into their homes. And that distance that we now take for granted between production and consumption, you know, between the sites of where food is made and our own eating of it, was a process that had to be developed, you know, that didn't happen overnight. And I think it helps. One of the reasons I got interested in the history of canned food was because I think it could help us to try to reframe our own perception to a time when such a widespread trust of all packaged food wasn't to be taken for granted, and to sort of consider where we do and don't trust modern packaged food as well.
My guest is Anna Zeta. She's assistant professor of professional practice at Oklahoma State University. Her new book is called Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. We'll talk more with Anna after a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or go to Twitter. We are @KERAThink. We are, of course, taking a break now because we are still in the spring membership campaign. Think today with a goal of raising $5,000. We have $4,490 left to raise, so we're off to a good start just a few minutes into the program here. You can make a contribution of support at 1-888-694-6931 or at kera.org. Samantha Guzman is here. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Chris. So when you make your contribution today, we have another one of our great giveaways, and today, this one is really cool. So when you make your contribution today to support KERA, your donation automatically enters you in a chance to win an Alamo Draft House Black Card. This gives you and a guest unlimited movies for an entire year.
That's amazing.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you make your contribution today, you're automatically entered into that drawing. That drawing is today. So if you want to get into it, you've got to make your contribution. You know, I just discovered Alamo Draft House like a year ago.
Super cool.
It's so cool. It was like life-changing. So if you like just discovered it and you get this black card, your weekends are up. That's it for the year you have planned. So make your contribution today by going online to kera.org, or you can give us a call at 888-694-6931.
Big thanks to the following members who have taken action today: Dr. Carissa Terranova of Dallas, Stephen Sage and Thomas Swiger from Dallas, also Regine Dupre from Dallas. Natalie Nickel from Dallas says, "Real news, real facts, not editorialized, run by the people and for the people with open minds." What a lovely thing to say. We thank you all for your contributions to the station. You can join this illustrious group at 888-694-6931 or kera.org. Sam, I think it's before your time. It is not intentional that the sound quality with Anna Zeta isn't perfect. She's on her way. She's in a studio. We're having some connection problems with that studio in Oklahoma. So she's talking to us on a phone. You can hear the crackle, and we apologize for that. And we are working on it. But I'll tell you, it used to sound like this every day on Think because we didn't have the budget to put people in a studio and give you that crystal clear audio. So you may not realize this, but a majority of the people who come on the show are actually not in studio with me. 60 to 70% are elsewhere, but we connect them in another radio studio somewhere else in the country or somewhere else in the world. And so the sound is identical. Listening in your car or in your house or in your office or over your computer, it sounds identical to the way it would sound if they were here. We're able to do that thanks to listener contributions. This is not a threat that we're going to go back to this, but it's your donations and your support of the show that's made it possible for us to not have crackly sound.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of things that you probably don't think about that your contribution goes to making possible. It's so our show sounds better, so we can put our guests in these studios. It also helps fund our podcast, so you can listen to the show not only when we air live from 12 to 2, but you can listen to the show whenever you want because you can subscribe to our podcast. Or it goes to, you know, funding our Facebook page, you know, so you can see what's coming up on the show and you can go to our website. Your contribution helps fund all those little things besides the daily program that you get every single day when you listen to the Think Show. All of that is made possible because of you and what you contribute to the station. So to continue to make those things possible, to continue to make Think sound as awesome as it does, make your contribution, show your support by going to kera.org or giving us a call at 888-694-6931.
When you go online, if you're interested in a thank you gift, you can check out the whole list there according to, you know, your membership level. Think about converting to a sustaining membership. Maybe every year you make a contribution and you wait until spring or you wait until fall. If you become a sustaining member, that membership cost is divided by 12 and a little comes out out of your account every month. You stay current as a KERA member, and of course, we can plan for the future because we know what's coming. And we do appreciate those of you who have already done this. Make your gift of support now at 888-694-6931 or at kera.org. Thanks. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is Anna Zeta, assistant professor of professional practice at Oklahoma State University and author of Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. Okay, Anna, so there's this question of trust. We have to know that the product is decent to eat and that it's safe to eat. There were some problems, some safety issues with early commercially canned goods.
That's right, yeah. In the earliest phases in the late 19th century, it was really just a basic problem of spoilage that you'd have, as they called them, swells and springers, you know, cans that would swell from various kinds of putrefaction that would create gases. Large portions of each canned food stock would just not even reach supermarket or grocery store shelves because of, you know, being visibly not intact. And also people would open cans and just find that the product inside had spoiled for various reasons. And so there was a loss financially for the canning companies and that real barrier to consumers trusting that when they opened the can, they'd find something good inside. But even more significant was the kind of spoilage that couldn't be seen as much, especially with botulism. Botulism comes from a bacteria that is sometimes accompanied by other bacteria that cause visible signs of decay, but sometimes not. And so it was a particularly kind of frightening bacteria, as well as the fact that it caused pretty rapid death, paralysis and death for people who had it. And there weren't that many cases of botulism, but when they emerged, they were really terrifying, and they created, you know, sometimes nationwide feelings of crisis. And I write in the book in particular about a case of botulism in canned ripe olives from California in 1919 and 1920. That caused about 10 deaths nationwide, and the way that the media really picked up on these reports of deaths from, you know, this food, from especially olives, were seen as a delicacy, something that was supposed to provide tastiness and comfort and a communal experience, instead led to these sort of grisly tales of death, and the way that that created a real nationwide concern.
So like, you know, corporate actors everywhere, canneries were really interested in preventing an onslaught of new government regulations. What were they afraid of if there was additional government oversight or any government oversight of their operations?
Well, actually, one of the interesting things I found when I wrote the story was that they actually welcomed a lot of regulation in the early phase. Before about 1930, there are a whole range of different kinds of regulations that canners actually wanted to impose upon themselves. So most tangibly, 20 years before the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act, which was in 1906, canners had gone to Congress requesting some kind of pure food law, both because they thought that if this law was in place, then it would sort of impart a stamp of approval, that consumers would see that the government had regulated these foods and therefore we could trust them. And they thought, well, if some of the less, canners who don't have methods that are as clean are not able to produce, then those of us who are bigger and more well-financed can rise to the top. So they were very instrumental in the passage of the Pure Food and Drug Act. By the time it came to pass after the publication of Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, the canners were also right there in the causation for that regulation. And then referring back to my botulism story that I was just sharing, that one of the things that the canning industry, especially the California canners, did immediately on the heels of those botulism deaths was call on the California State Health Service to institute a statewide cannery inspection service that was funded by the canners, asking them to send inspectors into the canneries of the state to make sure that they were doing things right. And that led not just to the oversight of olives, but all kinds of products that were canned in California, and other states also took on some of the same kinds of regulatory schemes in order to show consumers that it was, you know, there was some outside oversight. So one of the things I, you know, argue is that in those early phases of the industry, when the industry was still vulnerable, still needed someone besides themselves to show the consumers that this food was okay, they wanted government regulation. But that began to shift in the 1930s when canners sort of assumed a kind of confidence that they no longer needed those external stamps of approval as much.
There were some early experiments to try and convince people that what was in the can was good. Can you talk about, were they like little glass vials with samples of the product that were attached to the cans?
Yeah, right. So as I said, you know, one of the things they really battled was how do we make this opaque container not seem so opaque? So, you know, the phrase a window into the can was used very often. The idea that maybe something, the label itself or some other mechanism could help consumers see what was inside. And, you know, most tangibly, one of the things, there was a company called Visual Display Incorporated that tried to sell canners on this little, container, almost like a glass eyeball that sat on top of the can and would have a sample of what was inside, but fixed, you know, in some kind of clear jelly that would hold it in place, with the hope that this could be a little can, a window into the can that would help consumers say, okay, now I see what's inside. That never took off, I think, for a variety of reasons. Both logistically, it wasn't easy to produce those. And, you know, I think they even from the beginning realized that there was a kind of false equivalency, that something that's in a glass encased jelly on top of a can isn't actually what's inside the can. That's not what you're going to eat. And so consumers quickly called the canner's bluff on that attempt.
So when I was a kid, I remember noticing a lot of, you know, a can would say grade A fancy pears. And I would always wonder what that meant, because you never saw grade C pears in the grocery store or on your shelf at home. And I didn't know what made them fancy. So talk about how canned fruits and vegetables, and I guess maybe meats as well, started getting letter grades.
Yeah, well, that there was a real strong effort in the 1930s to put grades on all canned foods. In the way that meat is still graded today, not canned meat, but just cuts of meat. And this became a real power struggle that I write about between the federal government and the canning industry. This is the moment when the industry kind of asserts its confidence and says, we don't need your scheme for how to do this to the government. And so this was part of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal program. The National Recovery Administration had this plan to both help it boosts the economy through regulating labor, but they also had a consumers advisory council to say, what can we do on the consumer end of things to help consumers be more informed, that would then help them, you know, boost the economy through consumption. And one of their thoughts was that they would require all kinds of consumer products, but the canning code, the canning industry became the first test case for this plan to create sort of objective grade labels, so that consumers would understand when they were buying a product what they were getting. So you might buy grade A tomatoes if you wanted to serve them whole, say you wanted to, you know, create stuffed tomatoes, whereas you might buy grade C tomatoes if you're going to stew it down into a sauce anyway. And so it wasn't that C was inedible or not tasty, but it might be less refined, more pieces, more chunks, you know, less pure color, things like that. So things that gave consumers a sense of quality in a way that was objective. So they didn't just have to rely on brands or costs. And there were a lot of studies at the time that the most expensive cans actually were sometimes the least high quality, whereas, you know, lower cost would sometimes be better quality. And they thought, okay, if we can give consumers a more objective way to understand how to spend their money, that they'll be able to be more informed. And this was the idea of the National Recovery Administration. And canners really didn't want to do this. There were a lot of reasons that they pushed against this desire, even though it had been shown to work. The Canadian canning industry, for example, had done grade labels. And what they called for instead was what they called descriptive labeling. So they wanted to use words like fancy or premium to convey the same idea as A, B, and C, but without that kind of objective same sense. And, there were a lot of arguments that nature isn't standardized, so how can we, you know, presume to standardize the products of nature? Those kind of lofty statements. But fundamentally, what they were protecting was, by the 1930s, brands had come to have a real sense of clout. And the bigger companies like Campbell's and Del Monte that had emerged and are still big brands today didn't want their brand, the meaning of their brand, to be undercut by these A, B, and C labels, that if someone saw that not all Del Monte products were A, some of them were C, they might go buy the store brand instead. And so they wanted to hold on to their ability to define for consumers which were better and not through brands and not through government oversight.
Well, cans are really interesting also in thinking about the idea of food as a branded product. Again, this was a relatively new thing that wouldn't have made a whole lot of sense to people, you know, generations earlier.
Right, yeah. And that too, you know, I think brands emerged partly to help build this sense of trust, that if you came to know the name of a company, it was almost like knowing, you know, the name of your neighbor down the street from whom you used to always buy your meat or, you know, your eggs. That there was something about a name brand that could create a sense of familiarity. And you still see that today in marketing of big brands. They, you know, create associations that, that say, you know, this name stands for something healthy and good. And so this was a new idea that there could be nationally marketed brands that people across the country would have access to, not just the products of the regional cannery that, you know, canned whatever product was growing near me, that the new transportation routes and national marketing system allowed for people to have the same standardized products across the nation. And the rise of sort of marketing and advertising made it possible for people to have an awareness of what Campbell's, for example, stood for. You know, you had the rise of the little, like, cherub, round, rosy-cheeked Campbell's kids who stood for this kind of robust healthiness that Campbell's wanted to be associated with.
My guest is Anna Zeta. She's assistant professor of professional practice at Oklahoma State University. Her new book is called Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. We hope that you have already become part of the show by being a supporting member of the show, a patron of Think. You can do this by making a contribution of financial support at 1-888-694-6931 or at KERA.org. Started out with a goal to raise $5,000. We have just a little over $4,300 left to raise. Maybe you have considered joining the Jim Lehrer Roundtable with an annual contribution of $10,000 or more. Maybe you haven't thought about it or heard of it. The Jim Lehrer Roundtable honors Jim Lehrer, who, of course, was a Dallas-based journalism when he began when he began his career. Here at KERA, we are very proud of that association. Members of the Jim Lehrer Roundtable get really extraordinary benefits in addition to just knowing that they're supporting their favorite station. Invitations to exclusive events, meet and greets with people like Ari Shapiro and Ken Burns and Robert Siegel. The main benefit really is knowing that you're making an impact on your station for the entire community, that you are maybe, that your big contribution is helping hundreds of people who can't afford a membership to have access to a station like KERA. If you're interested in this, give us a call now at 888-694-6931 or go to KERA.org.
Couple people to thank. We have want to say thank you to the following members: Scott O. Dash from Keller, Michael Duplanty from Richardson. He says, listening to KERA deepens my experience of the world and changes my thought patterns. I am grateful to programs like Think. Also want to say thank you to Harky and Susan Dodia from Allen, who say, we love the absence of sound bites. We really love hearing people's stories. If you are like Michael or Scott or Susan and you listen to KERA because you appreciate programs like Think or Morning Edition, All Things Considered, The Takeaway, you know that your contribution goes to helping make all of those programs possible. You can make your contribution today by going online to KERA.org or giving us a call at 888-694-6931. And when you make your contribution, you get to pick one of our cool thank you gifts. And my favorite of the drive thus far is for $10 a month sustaining gift or a one-time $120 gift, you can get the Mr. Rogers Quote Tote. So it's this beautiful canvas, 12-ounce cotton canvas tote, and it has a zippered top, and it features all of these quotes on it for Mr. Rogers, like, anything is possible in make-believe, and remember to feed the fish. So when you make your contribution, all it takes is a $10 a month sustaining gift, and you can choose that as your thank you gift. Or if you're really enjoying today's program, you can select the book, Anna Zeta's book, about the canned food industry.
Yes, it's called Canned, the Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. This is my kind of thing. Like, I really like a micro history. And I have to say, this is a great show to be doing during our fundraising time, because we know that some people would say, wait, you're talking for an hour about the history of the canned food industry? And Think listeners are like, yes, because it is interesting. And it does have implications for how we became a country that is not just comfortable with, but sometimes struggling with our dependence on processed food. It's changed the way we think about our relationship to fresh versus preserved foods in all different kinds of ways. This is really interesting. Not everyone gets it. You get it. You're a listener to public radio. You're a listener to Think. You're on board. We really appreciate that. We invite you to become a member now to show that this is the kind of programming that you want. We know that, you know, that not every commercial station is going to do an hour-long interview on this, but that, you know, this is the kind of thing you're interested in. I'm seeing the board filling up with calls. This is the sort of show you want to participate in, ask questions, tell your own stories. This is why Think is here, because brains like yours are out there. You know, and it's really exciting. And if I sound excited, it's because I love doing this job and I love all of you who are listeners to the show and make it possible. I just ask that if you really are a lover of this programming, that you support it financially, because it takes that extra step. 888-694-6931 or kera.org.
You know, we get a lot of books into the Think offices, right, Chris? And this is one of those books that as soon as it passes across our table, we're like, oh, yeah. Canned? The history of canned foods? Like,
because we've never thought to think about it.
Exactly right. It's those topics that make you go, I never thought about it that way before. Or we connect the dots for you on topics that you think had nothing to do with each other. And you listen to an hour of Think, you're like, wow, now all of that makes sense. So it really is the perfect sort of thinky thing that we like to get into on the show like this. And you listen because you like those thinky topics too. Your contribution makes that possible. When you go online to kera.org, or if you give us a call at 888-694-6931, you know that your contribution today is standing with the trusted journalism that KERA provides you and the invaluable programming like Think. Give us a call, 888-694-6931.
Again, as Sam mentioned, if you would like your thank you gift to be a copy of Anna Zeta's book, Canned, we'd be delighted to send you one when you make a contribution at or above the level of $10 a month. You can set this up on a sustaining plan if you want, or do it all at once with a credit card. Do take action now, though. 888-694-6931 or kera.org. $4,000 left to raise against a goal of $5,000 for Think today. We know we can make this happen with your support. Thanks.
Sip on some soup. Have Campbell's chicken. They're twice as nice. Campbell's chicken.
This is no double talk. Every one of Campbell's chicken soups is made with two chicken stocks, one for richness, one for flavor. So they're richer and just plain more chickeny than chicken soup by any other name.
More chickeny than chicken soup. That is a 1967 Campbell's Soup TV ad. My guest this hour is Anna Zeta, assistant professor of professional practice at Oklahoma State University, author of the book Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. Campbell's was a big player from early on, right?
That's right. Yeah, I love hearing that ad. I hadn't heard that before.
By the way, you sound great. So we have you in the studio now. So
Yes.
I'm glad that we can hear you clearly. I want to go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. Actually, we'll hold off on phone calls for just a couple of minutes. I want to ask about the ways that scientists were used to prop up the canned food industry.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I did my PhD in the history of science, medicine, and technology. And so looking at the history of those kinds of fields that we tend to think of as quite distant sometimes from everyday consumer tastes, and yet canning used science from the very beginning as a really fundamental platform both from which to actually improve their products and also to build that kind of consumer trust. So there are many different ways in which this took place, everything from the very earliest entrances into bacteriology. So the canning industry was interested in funding bacteriology at universities well before that was a common practice, before you had the kind of R&D in major companies. They were looking to bacteriology as a science to say, what's going on in all of this spoiled food? How can we fund this science to help us solve our spoilage problems? There's also a lot of investment in agricultural science. So I have a whole chapter looking at the pea canning industry and how the pea canners in Wisconsin were some of the earliest funders from the business side of the University of Wisconsin College of Agriculture to address things like pesticides or how to breed a better pea that would better fit the canning system. So how can you mechanically harvest pea vines to make the process more efficient to put into the can? So all of these kinds of things, they relied on scientists and the relationships that they built to improve their products. And then they also broadcast their relationships with scientists to send out to a kind of a public that was coming to see science as an increasing source of expertise to say, we are working with these people you trust, so please trust what comes out of that process.
All right, let's jump on the phone now to Sydney in Lubbock. Hi, Sydney.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I'm enjoying this program very much, and thank you. I can't wait to read the book. When I was younger, I was first married and lived in a rural community in the panhandle of Texas, and there was like a local cannery, and it was a community mm-hmm. cannery, and people would like bring their produce, potatoes or for salsa or whatever, beans, chili, and they would work in this, I guess, industrial kitchen, and they would can, and you would come out with a like a silver can with no label. And I think uh-huh. they donated part of that to the community, and I just wondered if you had ever heard of that.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, it's great to hear that experience, because it is something I've read a lot about but haven't seen one in the present myself. But there were certainly a lot of community canneries in the early 20th century. During the Depression era, it was a major way to sort of help local communities put up their extra products, to not have to rely on the industrial industry, but to use the same methods within local communities. But individual farm families who couldn't themselves buy, you know, the equipment needed could go into these community canneries. And then during World War II, I've heard people talk about how you could go into these canneries and pack up cans of, you know, your son who's fighting abroad, his favorite spaghetti, and send a can overseas to someone who wanted a taste of home. And there's been some recent interest in these kind of community canneries. I know there are a couple in Virginia who are trying to reclaim that idea that, you know, having a more direct relationship with your own food preservation can give you a sense of control over this. But I haven't heard of them very widespread today. So it's interesting to hear that there's a more recent example of those community canneries. And I think they're a really interesting and cool resource.
How did the rise of canneries, there were thousands all over America eventually, how did they affect American farmers and the prices they could get for their produce?
Right. So that was, you know, in some ways, farmers have always been at the kind of whims of the market in terms of when things are in season, when you have harvest, that's when you get paid for a product. And one of the interesting things about canning was it could, depending on what product you were growing and how you were doing it, you could have a much more established and expected payoff, because you knew that the cannery would buy your whole crop and put it up for canning. And so you had a lot of different relationships. Some companies contracted with farmers, so they would just, you know, agree to buy whatever load of peas the farmer would bring in that spring. Others would grow, canning companies would grow their own crops, but bring in farmers and agricultural scientists to grow for them on company-owned land. And the farmers then got the fruits of the research that I mentioned earlier when canners invested in agricultural research to address issues like pests or fungal blight, that you know, the fruits of that knowledge, when done through extension programs through the state colleges of agriculture, would then also often benefit farmers. That's not to say a of course, as in any contracting situation, that there wasn't conflict between farmers and canners. There certainly was, in the sense that sometimes farmers thought they should get a much better price than they were being paid by the canners, especially when they saw that they would sell, you know, a bushel of peas for 3 cents, and then that same can of peas would be 10 cents in the store. And that kind of concern about where the middlemen would enter into that market economy to add, value-added products, but that the farmers ultimately weren't getting as much of that final dollar as they thought they deserved. So there had to be legal contracts drawn up often to sort of mediate that relationship between the farmers and the canners.
So if the mid-20th century was like the golden age of canned food, when they had, these what you call can opener cooks, you know, people who were like really proud of making a whole meal of nothing but canned food.
Right.
There's always a backlash, right? So how did, like in the 70s, the environmental movement and the, concern about what we were eating affect the acceptance of canned food?
Yeah, so... even though the kind of growth of the industry in terms of cans sold and produced didn't really level off that much during this time, there was definitely in the public eye a sense that canned food, along with so many other kind of symptoms of, broader industry or the government, these kinds of groups that in the Vietnam era and concerns about environmental problems, that people in the counterculture were starting to sort of doubt that we should be trusting these bigger forces, and canned food fell into that as well. You had a lot of people in the counterculture looking to alternate modes of food, the back to the land movement of growing their own foods, often in organic ways, the rise of organic farming. So all of these kinds of counter trends pushed against what the canning industry stood for. All the way, as I had said, the canners were relying on this kind of authority of science and technology to say, trust our products. But now that science and technology was coming to be doubted and held up as a potential problem in the age of chemical warfare and post-atomic bomb, these kinds of concerns then translated to the fruits of that science and technology, which was this industrial food process. At the same time, though, the canning industry was really becoming aligned with and caught up in other kinds of processed foods. By now, you have the rise of frozen foods. You have the emergence of other kinds of packaged foods that we now see all over the place. And so in some ways, the canners were growing stronger because they were now allied with these other processed foods. But they were very aware and concerned to not let that kind of countercultural pressure against them tank the idea of canned food as a staple of the American diet in the 60s and 70s.
You say that cans helped to transform consumers' imagination of what was possible. On balance, has that been a good thing or a bad thing for us?
Well, I think, you know, it's a complicated question, as so many historical questions are. I think that, you know, on the whole, the canning industry really did open up a kind of accessibility of food, especially today, relatively affordable food to lots of people for whom, you know, fresh foods or organic foods aren't accessible. They are still the staple of, you know, food drives and food pantries. And as people, you know, concerns about people prepping for the apocalypse, you know, they stock their underground cellars with canned food because it does provide this really almost unparalleled technology that you can't get with frozen foods or other packaged foods because of the requirement to keep those things frozen or keep them in a certain way. And canned food really do have this long shelf life. So, of course, I think that it opened up a wide range of possibility in what we have available to us. At the same time, I think, as with any kind of technology that grows quite large and becomes less able to be attentive to consumer interests or needs, less open to recognizing the way that public concerns might be valid, that there's ways in which canned food and the larger processed food that it stands for today, I think, does need to be aware of how, you know, we might welcome regulation or welcome more consumer input about what they want that processed food to look like.
Anna Zeta is Assistant Professor of Professional Practice at Oklahoma State University and author of Canned, The Rise and Fall of Consumer Confidence in the American Food Industry. Anna, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to thank all of you listening today, especially those of you who are members of KERA. I know there are at least a few new and renewing members that we've heard from this hour. We're looking to raise $3,760 between now and 2 o'clock. We can do it with your help. You know, one reason that we used to, you probably have noticed if you're a longtime listener, that the drives used to go on much longer. They're a little shorter now, in part because we hear from people earlier, but also because we have more and more sustaining members. People who become a member, you're a member at $5 a month or $50 a month or $125 a month or whatever, but you get on that sustaining plan and then you just stay on that plan. It's easy to change if you need to do so for whatever reason, but it just keeps your membership current. It's very convenient for folks who listen and want to support KERA, and it's great for the station. And because we have those sustaining memberships, we don't have to get as many new people, as many one-time gifts as we once did. But our goal is for everyone who listens regularly to be a sustaining member. And if you haven't made that choice yet, we ask that you consider it now at 888-694-6931, or just go check things out at kera.org. You can see thank you gifts, including thank you gift copies of Anna Zeta's book, Canned, which is very interesting.
Yeah, and the great thing about a sustaining membership is that, you know, you just set it for the year and then you don't have to worry about it. You
Long
know?
Shelf life.
Right, exactly. Just like cans.
Right.
So you can do that by going online to kera.org. It's great because you can do whatever amount is most comfortable for you. Maybe it's $10 a month. Maybe it's $20 a month. You can always change it. Give more, give less. Every little bit counts. And we really appreciate our sustaining members because that is money that we can count on. You know, we are sure that that's coming in every single month. So want to say thank you to a couple of people here. Dr. Jan M. Tribig from Arlington, Mr. and Mrs. Robert Leland from Ponder, John Davis from Denton. Thank you all for making your contribution today. Also want to say thank you to Kirk Booknight from Fate, Texas, who says he loves Think. And then Catherine Wadley, she says KRA has important stories and news I wouldn't hear anywhere else. And more importantly, in a time where media is under attack, we must support our freedom of speech and information. Thank you, Catherine, for your kind words, and thank you for everyone else for making your contribution. If you're like Catherine and you know that KRA provides you with the in-depth storytelling that, you know, your life just wouldn't be the same if you weren't, you know, getting our series like One Crisis Away, American Graduate, that like really take a deep dive into some local issues going on in education or looking at different angles of poverty here in North Texas. Or maybe you're a loyal listener to Think, you know, and you eat lunch every single day with Chris Boyd. Your contribution makes all of that possible. So you can continue to support KERA by going online to kera.org or by giving us a call at 888-694-6931. And remember, when you make your contribution today, you're automatically entered in for a chance to win that Alamo Drafthouse Black Card, Chris. So that gives you unlimited movies for a whole year.
Pretty awesome deal if
Pretty
you
cool.
are the winner. And no matter what, you will win another great year of radio. The thing about a KERA membership is it really is an investment in your brain and your access to information and knowledge and in your community. There are very few charitable contributions you can make where you benefit 100%, and so does everyone else who listens. You know, we talk about sometimes we have these drives and somebody will match your contribution. If you think about it, you and hundreds of thousands of people benefit from the contribution that you choose to make right now, whether that's $10,000 as a Jim Lehrer Roundtable member, $1,500 as a friend of KERA, or $5 a month as a basic member. Everybody benefits.
That's right. You make your contribution, you get to listen to the programming, and you provide a service to all of the other North Texans that appreciate KERA radio. You can make your contribution by going online to KERA.org or giving us a call at 888-694-6931, and thank you.